So here's a drawing prompt for you. You have a pen or pencil, piece of paper? How would you depict the interior of your mind? Would it look like a scribble or a web or maybe a cloud? Mine's kind of a Jackson Pollock looking thing, more or less chaos. Detroit-based artist Elizabeth Youngblood explores interiors and other matters in her new solo exhibition titled Room Tone. It's on view right now at M Contemporary Gallery in Ferndale. And today, we're talking to her all about it. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Elizabeth Youngblood's new solo exhibition features neat, thread-like drawings, along with foggy abstract shapes smudged with graphite. She is an artist who has conquered a whole range of artistic mediums, from ceramics to fiber art to sculpture. And in a former life, she was a sought-after graphic designer in New York. Elizabeth Youngblood, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You've done several series of drawings, some of which we see in this exhibition, in which you follow one line, almost as one follows the thread of a thought. And the line takes on a shape and ultimately a surface, and some eventually, I guess, take on almost three dimensions, a built shape. How did this process start for you of drawing in this way?
Well, it came from weaving. So they really came from trying to figure out how I could replicate what I considered to be the beauty of a chained-up warp. And that also related to the process, you know, it's a thinking process for me. And so drawing those lines was also a matter of replicating a thought. That was the intention initially, was to try to repeat the same line, which of course is impossible to do. And that's also a metaphor for the way you change from one day to another. And it also ties to the weaving metaphor again, because you are building a surface. When you're weaving, you're building a plane of cloth. And when I'm drawing these lines, I'm building a plane again, which is the shape that you spoke it better than I am. but they're all related. And then, of course, I was a graphic designer too, and I did a lot of typography. And again, it's a similar situation. When we used to teach, we taught the dot, the dash, the line, the plane, which is the dot is the letter form, the dash is the word, the line is the line of words that makes the line of a paragraph, and then the several lines make up a paragraph. And so we taught about type in terms of form, the way that I draw, those line drawings make form.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in your mind when you're working on these pieces, whether they're weavings or the drawings? Are you in a thought process, or is it more sort of a liminal state where thought kind of suspends for a while?
For the line drawings, they start as a thought, and then it moves into a more liminal space. I get interested in the form. There will be something that my hand will do. Sometimes there'll be a, you know, there'll be something under the paper, so the line, I hit that thing under the paper so the line isn't as straight and there's a wiggle in it. Or when you see many lines that are basically parallel and then all of a sudden one goes off to the side, I think of that as a thought wandering. Or it changes from a solid line to a series of tiny little dots. Again, that's, you know, that's a thought changing or my mind wandering off to something else. When I'm weaving, unless I'm really just weaving fabric, I'm kind of paying attention. You know, I'm paying attention to the edges. But when you're weaving yardage, it does become something that's very physical. It's kind of like a dance, you know, because it's all rhythm. You know, you're stepping on a treadle, you have to make sure you're stepping on the right treadle, but you kind of line them up in a way that makes sense. And then once you get going, it's all kind of muscle memory, and it's really kind of meditative. But if I'm weaving something kind of more experimental, I have to pay attention.
This exhibition is called Room Tone, And folks who've ever been on a film set or done video production know that room tone is when you freeze everything for 90 seconds or more, just sort of stop people from moving or speaking, and record the sounds of a room with nobody in motion. And it's used in the editing process to provide background sound or some continuity. Why did you choose that title?
Oh, just because when I learned what it was, I thought this is perfect because, well, a room tone is a reading. It's a reading of the room. It's a reading of the room with all the people in place, with all the furniture in place. And it's from a very specific, if I understand this properly, it's from a very specific location in the room. And if you moved the recording equipment to another place in the room tone would be different. So it's unique. And I considered these drawings and the way that they're related to thought, or the way that they're at least based in thought and in process, I think of them as readings for, I can't come up with a better word for it. I've been trying to find a better word than mindscape. It's kind of a reading of what's going on in my head. Mm-hmm. And I really like the metaphor because of the specificity of what room tone is for each location that it's taken from or taken within.
When you come to a piece, do you have a plan for the shape that you want it to take? Or does the thought come after your instinct of it?
For the graphite pieces, the larger ones, do you understand which ones are the graphite pieces?
Yeah, these are works using graphite on paper, but they're not pencil drawings. They're almost like paintings that you make with graphite
powder.
Yeah,
it's powdered graphite, right. So they don't look like pencil drawings. But those, yes, I do plan the shape to a certain extent. Sometimes I actually even use pencil markings, you know, to make sure that it's centered, or at least to start it. I know where the center of the page is. I know how far I want to stay from the edges. So for those pieces, yes, I do go in with a plan. For the fine line drawings, sometimes yes and sometimes no. I'm beginning to work in a series for the line drawings too. And so for those, I might start with the notion of a form, like a butte or a motion of bending. So more recently with the line drawings, I am starting to think about a form later, a form that I want things to kind of move in the direction of. But while I'm doing it, my mind could wander somewhere else and it could change. I could kind of abandon my original plan for the line drawings. For the graphite ones, not so much.
What does it mean to have the time to follow a thought through in that way? Is that something that you've always been able to make time to do?
I think the short answer is no. I was very impatient as a young person. I couldn't imagine weaving, just dressing a loom, you know, pulling each thread through two different stages. You know, and you have hundreds of threads sometimes. I just couldn't imagine doing it. First time I ever wove was in high school, and I only had 8 ends per inch. You know, and the thing was only 10 inches wide, but the thought of handling 100 ends just made me nuts. So no, I haven't always been that way. I've really gained a lot of patience as I've aged, and it does take some doing. I have to be in the right mood to sit down and do that work. I call it butt in the chair time. I really do have to sometimes just take myself by the collar and sit down and work. But, you know, I've kind of always been that way. But now I can just sit there for hours. You know, I could sit there for a long time and do it. And I watched it in my students, too. They need a break. If we have classes an hour and a half, they need a break in between. I remember when it struck me how I used to need a break too, for if an hour and a half session was going to happen. And, you know, as I matured, I mean, I could work all day without a break.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, more of our conversation with Elizabeth Youngblood. Stick around.
Mm-hmm. Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
You're so versed in so many different disciplines. Like we mentioned, you had this successful career as a graphic designer. And early in your education, you were very active with ceramics. And you've done ink and bookmaking, lots of printed disciplines. But it's clear that weaving is pretty key. Could you talk a little bit about why weaving became important to you?
Well, I grew up sewing. I'm of an age where just about everybody learned to sew. I mean, you could make a skirt, you know, you could make a dress. Mm-hmm. And I come from a creative family. My aunt was a wonderful cook, and again, everybody knew how to sew, especially the generation beyond me. My mother made a lot of our clothes. She knitted. My uncle had a woodworking shop, and so I learned to, you know, run power tools and stuff with him. So in his workshop. So, you know, making stuff has always been of interest to me. I guess when I was at Cranbrook is where it really caught my interest, because I saw people really doing interesting things on a loom. And then I remembered that one little piece that I did in high school. And here was a whole department. You know, the things that you can do with it, the fact that a loom is a machine, really, and that you have so much control over what the output is, because, you know, you have heddles and treadles, and you have all kinds of combinations. And the more heddles and the more treadles you have, and the more harnesses you have, the more intricate stuff you can do. You can weave more than one plane of cloth at a time. You can have them intersect, you know, horizontally and vertically, you know, weft-wise and warp-wise. So it's just fascinating. There's so many things you can do just that are functional. And then if you start to play around with it experimentally, you know, fool with tension, and you can weave seersucker. I mean, that's what seersucker was. It's just two different tensions. And so it's just endlessly fascinating to me.
You spent some time, as we mentioned, on the East Coast in your graphic design career, and you did work for places like the New York Times, and then, I want to say about 20 years ago, you came back to Detroit. What's it been like to make a life as a working artist here?
Oh, gee. I'm loving it. I really am. I just didn't know how to do it as a younger person, and I don't know whether I just didn't have the knowledge, or whether we really didn't have the opportunity. And I think it's a little bit of both, because kids come out of graduate school now, and even undergraduate school, and they can see the way. They're the galleries, you know, where they can start to show their work, and they can, you know, begin to professionalize the way that it's presented, and their residencies and things that you can go on. So I found it to be really terrific. And I was still practicing design when I moved back, and I was also teaching. So I sort of phased into making art only and phased out of teaching and doing graphic design. But it's really been terrific.
Well, just as you've had this sort of dual existence within graphic design and contemporary art, your work kind of straddles this line between fine art and studio craft, which in art circles seems like they've always had this sort of Oscar and Felix kind of relationship.
That's a good way to describe it.
Well, the art world sometimes hasn't had much use for craft, you know, as if people who focus on their craftsmanship somehow have less to say. Whereas the contemporary craft world finds the art world kind of exclusionary and maybe even lacking in some discipline. Have you felt a need to position yourself between these two poles in your work?
No, I guess I'm not successful enough to have had to, you know, wrestle with that one, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Personally, I mean, because I believe in craftsmanship and I understand a certain amount of rigor and discipline and knowing some things, and you have to know and follow certain things in, say, ceramics just to, you know, get it to hold together or not blow up or, you know, overfire or all kinds of things like that. And I have that skill. In fine art, for instance, I'm not a painter. I don't know the craft of painting. You know, with oil painting, you put on thicker and thinner layers, you know, in various orders, and, you know, there's ways to thin your oils and so forth, your paints. And see, I don't know any of that. So I feel like I can't be a painter. But my drawing and stuff, I'm kind of in the experimental side of that. So rigor isn't, you know, the draftsmanship, for instance, isn't real important in what I do in terms of drawing. And I guess I would be hard-pressed to do a wonderful portrait of you because figurative work is so prominent and having such a wonderful kind of resurgence here in Detroit. I wouldn't be able to do that. So I am happy kind of in the abstract mode for my fine art, for the drawings. And in ceramics, where I do know the edges, you know, the rules, and a lot of the rules for weaving, I like to kind of push those and see how far I can, you know, how thin can I get this porcelain without it falling apart? You know, how much, because, you know, you don't mix different clay bodies and so forth for various reasons. Because when you do, you know, they shrink at different rates and so forth, and they don't hold together. Well, I'm real interested in putting them together and seeing how far I can get away with that. So, again, where there are the rules and I know the rules, I want to push them. And where I don't know the rules, that's okay, because I want to work in a more experimental way anyhow.
There's been some scholarship around the fact that the studio craft movement has been a little bit more welcoming to women of color than the contemporary art spaces are, partly because of all the gatekeeping that happens within the art world. Has that been your experience?
I would say no. In my experience, especially lately, and in Detroit, I've seen more people of color in the fine art world than I have, say, in the crafts world, in ceramics and weaving and so forth. Now, you know, weaving had sort of fallen out of favor. You know, the departments were getting smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a place that I think fewer and fewer young people were identifying it as a way to move forward. And in ceramics, less so, because you can always be a potter. I mean, people can think of it that way. And then, of course, you can always take it to the fine art end, too. So I would say that hasn't been the case for me, but I didn't push real deeply into crafts as a way to make a living. Now, there might be another universe when you get further into it than I went into it. But that's interesting. I'm going to have to look into that more.
Well, Elizabeth Youngblood, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for taking a few minutes to tell us about your work.
Well, thank you for your interest. You have no idea how much it means when people are interested in what you do.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. You can find the full Stateside show at michiganradio.org. And just a reminder here, if you like what you're hearing, we'd love it if you could rate the show and leave us a review, either on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Helps other people find what we're doing. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Our theme music is by 14KT. Additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Ishikawa. Thank you so much for listening, and get some sunshine this weekend. We'll see you Monday.